Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, this is Ryan Fraser.
This is Troy Daley.
This is Gus Boyett.
This is Don Hutchison.
This is Jürgen Klopp, and you're listening to The Big Interview with Graham Hunter.
Thank you, Jürgen. I travel to all these interviews from Barcelona, and our socios, our beloved members, keep us on the road. This independent podcast wouldn't happen without them. Please go to patreon.com/Graham Hunter right now to join us, to become a socio, and to get every interview we produce without adverts, and before it goes out on the main feed, plus lots of bonus content, including the chance to put questions to our guests and to me via the monthly Q&A. You will also get bonus content every month, including the audio versions of my regular columns for ESPN. So do please go to patreon.com/Graham Hunter and join the club and get your family and friends to do so. Maybe even strangers in the street. Love you. Of course, to somebody of my generation, it feels astonishing that not all of you will remember that there was a country called Yugoslavia. Not all of you will remember that Denmark won the Euros in 1992 or how that came about. So, this is what the big interview's for, I think. This episode is with the Crown Prince of that triumph, one of the great, elegant, technically gifted, thrilling footballers of our generation, Brian Laudrup. Brian joins us to give a forensic breakdown of how Denmark won those Euros in what is one of the two great all-time underdog international tournament win stories. The success actually was born in the club called Brøndby, the Danes call it, I think, years previously, where an incredible coming together of talent, including Brian Laudrup, Peter Schmeichel, amongst many others, laid foundations for what was to happen with the national team in 1992. This tale has everything. A real clash of football beliefs and personal animus, which resulted in both Brian Laudrup and Michael Laudrup quitting the Danish team, managed by Richard Møller-Nielsen, the same man who would eventually bring glory to Denmark, before Brian decided to return before the tournament, not because he sniffed glory, for completely different reasons, and then suddenly the opportunity to play in the Euros in Sweden was thrust upon him. He tells us everything about that, the stress. He looks each way and talks about some of the key members of the team, including Schmeichel. He explains to us why he and his brother quit, why they left Richard Møller-Nielsen to his devices as coach of Denmark, and how it was that Møller-Nielsen came to persuade Brian to rejoin. The 11th hour inclusion of the Danes in the tournament, at the exclusion of the aforementioned Yugoslavia, who were disqualified after war broke out in the Balkans, didn't immediately look as if it would be a fairy tale story for the Danes. However, this goes on to be a tale of epic proportions, featuring players like Effenberg, Klinsmann, Jean-Pierre Papin, Eric Cantona. Can the Danes really do it? Enjoy part one. Stay tuned for part two tomorrow, and we'll break down the tournament game by game. It's a truly great story. Enjoy. Big interview listeners, we've got a bit of a privilege today. We are talking to the hero, the best player of one of the greatest international tournaments ever. And I'll let you know, listeners, there have been 36 European Championship and World Cup tournaments combined. And in my opinion, there only has ever been really two great underdog stories. And how appropriate it is just in the day that we're talking to be saying Viva the underdog and let's not be ruled by the big money people all the time. Those stories are Greece and Denmark winning the European Championship. And I'd argue that the Greece thing is wonderful for the people of that country, but they weren't an inspirational side. They were, in fact, pretty dull. Leaving one underdog story in the entire history of the World Cup and the European Championship, which is Denmark in 92. And we have the best player of that tournament. We have one of the men of the team of the tournament. We have the inspiration for the men in red and white, Mr. Brian Laudrup. Good morning. I guess you recognise the description that I'm giving there because you did it.
We absolutely did it. I mean, it's strange to sit here and talk about something which happened, you know, 29 years ago. I mean, the time flies, as you know, and but it comes to my mind, you know, the sensation, you know, the feelings we had as players, you know, going to a tournament, thinking about, okay, can we just, if we get one point, that would be a huge success. We don't want to be slaughtered. We don't want to just be criticized. We don't want to make up the numbers, but we have to sell ourselves as well as we can. And then ending up winning it. I mean, it was absolutely crazy stuff. And to this day, I think it's changed a lot of the players' lives, really.
Can I take you back? Because we want to make this a really forensic examination of the tournament. We like people to feel like they were there and to understand it. Please feel free to tell me I'm wrong when I put forward ideas. But we've worked on this and I was lucky enough to have enjoyed it. I wasn't full-time journalism at the time, but I was really rooting for Denmark. You were an exciting side. There are other reasons I was rooting for you. But I want to start by going back to what I call the Brøndby bunch. Because, again, if I'm right, number one, there had only been really a clutch of years since Brøndby had become the first full-time professional club in your country. And secondly, although we have to look at the team once you'd left Brøndby that got to the Champions League, the European Cup semi-final, my eye is nonetheless taken to the Porto game. The Roma game was in the UEFA Cup when she left, but the Porto game, the quarterfinals of the European Cup. And if I look at that side, I think there are six that started against Porto in a massively tight tie against the side that went on to win the European Cup that season. So you very nearly created a miracle before the miracle. And to carry that group, plus others, who go on to eventually play Germany, how much in professionalism, in culture, in the conglomeration of great players, in the European experience against Porto, did Brøndby look like a tributary, a beginning for what happened in 92?
I think it was a huge train that got moving when Brøndby back in, I think it was 85 or was it 86, became full-time professionals. It was something which had never, you know, seen the light of the day in Denmark. You know, we were amateurs. And, you know, happy, you know, good old-time amateurs. And if you wanted to play professionally, you had to go abroad, obviously. So this team that was created was, and we didn't know that we were going to create a fantastic team back then. But, you know, if you look at the team, and I can, you know, mention, give you names like Peter Schmeichel, you know, John Jensen, Kim Vilfort, you know, a lot of, you know, players that, you know, five or 6 years on would play in the Euro 92. So obviously we were a team that played together for a number of years. And I think that was one of the reasons behind the success, really. I think we, you know, it's strange, really, because from one day to another, we were like, you know, a team that used to train perhaps three, perhaps four times a week. And all of a sudden, we were full-time professionals, you know, training twice a day and living, you know, the professional football life. And that changed, I think, the mentality of Denmark, because I think we went from, as I say again, you know, being, you know, people that, you know, love to play football after work, you know, and not being professionals really, to start perform like that and live like professionals. And I think, as I say again, you know, it changed the whole idea of football in Denmark, and to this day changed perhaps the perception of Denmark as a footballing country as well.
Brian, if you take what you've been describing there about the change from a slightly happy-go-lucky, talent-based mentality when you're amateurs to the full professional life, the impact of that, there hasn't been long for it to have an impact. If Brøndby goes professional in about 86, the Porto tie is in 87. Can I put forward then that given that you run the eventual European Cup winners very, very close, the group of Schmeichel, Bjarne Jensen, Ole Østergaard, Lars Olsen, Kent Nielsen, Ole Madsen, Kim Vilfort, Peter Steffensen, Henrik Jensen, John Jensen, Klaus Nielsen, Tommy Christensen, yourself, coached by the late Ebbe Skovdal, much loved in Aberdeen. Does that say that there must have been a hell of a lot of talent and character, because you didn't run Porto so close based on all the years of build-up of professionalism? 12 months doesn't make a massive difference. That must have been one hell of a group.
That was one hell of a group. It was, I mean, for me personally, you know, stepping into that group at the age of 17, it was a nightmare, I tell you. I mean, can you imagine your seasoned pros and here comes Brian, you know, Michael's little brother. Can he do anything at all? Is he a player? So I had to, I had some stick to, you know, and you know, I had to prove that, you know, I could play a wee bit, you know. So, but having said that, and you're completely right, it was a fantastic bunch of players, because I think we came together at the right time. There was, you know, a lot of players with, you know, great experience even back then, not being professionals, but having played, you know, the game for a number of years. And then all the professionals, these talents bought from various places. Peter Schmeichel came from a small club in the area, to all the other players, you know, gathered at Brøndby. And I think there's no doubt about it. We ran Porto very close. I'm not saying I was the finished article back then, but I remember, you know, playing a few minutes in both games. And Paulo Futre, you know, he was the big Porto player. I loved him. What a player he was. And but, you know, there's something about Denmark, and I think Scotland has got the same, you know, this underdog feeling that, you know, when you go out against the big guns, we always seem to produce the goods. And I'm not saying that we didn't beat Porto over the two legs, but we came very close, as you say. And I think that made Brøndby and Danish football realize that, hey, 5, 10 years, 15 years from now, we can compete against the big boys in European football. And being part of that was absolutely incredible.
Can I share something that I sat down with Peter Schmeichel in 2014, just before the making of the film of this brilliant tournament that you won. And I asked him, and I want to quote him to try and get you to explain if anything similar at all happened to you. He talks about the game in Das Antas in Porto, and he says specifically, that was by a long, long stretch the biggest game I would ever play. That day was my biggest day. Most people I had ever played in front of, about 80,000. And he says, Brian, I remember how scared I was, because we sat on the coach on the way to Das Antas with a full police escort. I'd never seen anything like it before. Basically, it was just a normal road, not a dual carriageway, and they were taking us down the middle of the road. Cars had to fly out of our way. That really scared me. He says, really, really scared me, but so did the game. Peter said, all I could think about was, I really hope we don't get there. I hope the bus will turn around or it'll break down and we'll go somewhere else. Honestly, I couldn't face playing the game. I was very nervous. and physically I was shaking and sweating. He then goes on to say that he talks to himself in the stadium. He says, Peter, this is crazy. This is what you worked for all your life. And he says that he took the nerves, talked himself out of them, and never felt nervous again. Now, I expect it wasn't identical for you, but that is a life-changing, not a career-changing moment. That's extraordinary. Does it ring any bells with you?
I think it's extraordinary coming from Peter Schmeichel, to be honest with you. But that shows you that, you know, we were young, we were very inexperienced, you know, at that level. Sometimes it can be very daunting and very scary, perhaps, to at a very young age to all of a sudden, you know, play in the European Cup, play the big team like Porto. We have been seeing Porto. Porto back then was like perhaps, well, not comparable, but it's for us at least, it was like perhaps watching Real Madrid or, you know, Barcelona nowadays. So for us, it was all about not, how can you say it, try and perform as well as we could, but knowing that we were immensely, I mean, we were underdogs in a big, big way, and just trying to, trying to perform at that level. But I think, as Peter Schmeichel mentioned it, and I think I was even younger than he was. For me, it was I came on, I think, in the second half. I played perhaps, as I recall it, 10, 15 minutes. You know, I remember Ebbe Skoldal, who was my uncle. He told me just before I went on the pitch, he says, Brian, get the ball, do something, take people on. And I was like, yeah, what are you talking about? You know, I was 17 or 18. But again, you know, I think it was an eye-opener, really. And I think it's one of these experiences that you have to get through. And then after the game, you realize how lucky you've been, you know, to play at that level, to actually, you know, running very, you know, very close to a huge upset, and then realize I want more of this. You know, this was the appetizer. You know, now you want the main course, and I think for a number of us, I left, you know, Bremby 2 years later, but some of them, you know, stayed on and played in the semifinals against, you know, Roma and all that. I went to Germany back then, but you know, this team set the standards, which to this day has not been surpassed. You know, it's not been, you know, FC Copenhagen, they have come close. They've done extremely well in European football, but no Danish team has ever gone as far as Brøndby did. And that's what makes me proud of being part of it.
I wonder, when your work with Brøndby and with Bayer Erdogan culminates in you being handed your first international jersey, you mentioned your elder brother, but you didn't mention your dad, Finn, who's a Danish footballing legend, a leader, an exceptionally good attacking player. He became a coach, an international footballer who really only wore his last international jersey about 11 years before you win the European Championship, which is pretty extraordinary. When that first call-up comes, what do you, you know, what does it do to you? What does it feel like? What is the badge and the colours of the Danish international shirt? I mean, the heritage of knowing what your father had been, that first moment representing your country, and did you keep a souvenir? What's the experience for you?
Yeah, the experience was remarkable. I mean, being part of this family was always very tough for me. I think it's understandable. I think you understand it as well. Having a father being back then, some sort of an icon. It was a different era, obviously, and not with social media, and not, you know, as I say again, no professionals in Denmark. Even if you played as a professional abroad, you were not allowed to play for the national team. It was crazy. It was completely different to what it is today. So my father, he only played 22 games for Denmark. He could have played at least three times as much as that. But having said that, he was a fantastic footballer, loved in this country, some more than others, but he was certainly a wonderful, gifted technical player. And then my brother came along, and the rest is history. You know, he was, and quite rightly so, you know, regarded as the best player perhaps ever to come out of this country. And then, you know, 5 years later, I joined the scene as well. So at times, I have to say it was very difficult, because when I was 7, 8, as a youth player, you know, I couldn't hide anywhere. You know, people would say, oh, there's, you know, Finn's son or Michael's brother. He's going to be the best of them all. Can you imagine that with at the age of 7, 8, 9? So the expectation level, I think, was at times too much for me. And I had difficulties coping with that. But eventually, I remember when I was 15, I stopped playing for a while, just to find out with myself, is this the path you want to go? Is this the, you know, do you want to be compared all the time? Do you want to becoming known perhaps as the only one in this family and not being a good player, despite perhaps having a talent? But after 2 weeks, I just decided, listen, I love football. You know, I love to play. And for me, it was all about, you know, enjoying myself. It was not about playing for Denmark. It was not about playing abroad, but it was about enjoying the game. And I think after the 2 weeks, I decided, okay, let's give it, I'll go all in and see how far it takes me. And having, by your question about playing for Denmark was the biggest dream for me coming true. I mean, my father played, my brother, I went to Germany when Denmark played in the Euro 88. It was a poor Euros for Denmark, but you know, I was standing in the stands, you know, with the Danish fans and celebrating the Danish team and trying to encourage them. So I've always been a fan myself. And to then back in, I think it was 87, I was called up for the first time. It was actually my brother who was injured. So I came in his place. So we didn't actually play together in that game. And I didn't even, you know, play in that game. But it was the first time that, you know, I turned up with these fantastic players like Preb Melchior, you know, Morten Olsen, Søren Lervi, Frank Arnesen, all these heroes, Jesper Olsen. They were legends. I mean, for me, it was all about, again, you know, trying to do as well and you know, suck all in and hopefully learn a lot of things. So for me, that's the biggest moment, I think, so far in my career. I was only 18 when I played my first game. I think it was in Austria, and I was born in Vienna. My father played in Vienna back then. So it was a curiosity for me to incredibly to play my first game in Vienna, where I was born. A strange feeling in some ways, but it made me realize that I want more. As I said, you know, before against the Porto game, when you experience that feeling of you know, going out in front of your you know, with the Danish top on, playing for your country. I think I speak for any footballer in anywhere in the world, that's the biggest feeling you can ever get.
I have to ask you about the strange things that happened when Sepp Piontek, who'd been the coach of this dazzling Danish team in 86, which, again, some people, it'll be a Marmite experience. Do you remember the Uruguay thrashing? Do you remember the way in which they sneakily went past Scotland, which obviously was just a total travesty? Do you remember the Spain game and coming forward? 88 isn't fantastic. There's no qualification for 90, and Piontek goes. Now, I think it would be lazy of me to say, I wonder if you had an influence. And it's quite late to be investigating a news story, but the choice of coach initially is Horst Wöllers, who is your coach at Bayer Erdogan. Now, I'm not saying that you called up the Danish FA and said, listen, lads, I've got it all sorted. But it's a hell of a coincidence. And it also, what happens is quite strange. And it's not Horst who leads you forward to the triumph of 92. In fact, Horst doesn't really make it past a day in the job.
Listen, it was, and I'm perfectly honest here, the Danish FA never, ever called me about Horst Wöllers. And he obviously never told me anything. before you were sitting at a press conference in Copenhagen. Can you imagine that?
That's so weird.
I remember, you know, being in Erding, and on the day, Bonhof, who was a world famous German international as well. He played in Spain. He was he was the assistant. And he says, Horst, he's not here today, so I'll do the training session. And I was like, what? And the next thing I hear is that he flew to Denmark and attending, you know, a press conference. What he was not, you know, aware of is that at this press conference, they're actually telling that he's signed a contract and he's the new, you know, the new manager for the Danish national team. So obviously they were not happy about that at Bayer Rudding. And it never came about because they didn't accept that. So it was very strange for me. It was a strange moment for Danish football and a humiliating one as well. I think it was not the finest hour of the Danish FA by not having, you know, secured his signature, not being aware that he had a contract for another 2 years at Bayer Leverkusen. But it highlighted the fact that Richard Møller Nielsen, who eventually, you know, became the manager, who was actually the assistant of Piontek, he came forward and got the job. And what an engagement that was. I mean, for him to, well, he was not considered really, I think that's sometimes a problem in Denmark. I don't know whether that's in the football world as in general, but being assistant and then turning into the manager can sometimes be quite difficult. And I think especially with the 86 team, 88, you know, 84 as well, Richard Møller Nielsen, he was seen as perhaps more or less the guy who just, you know, joins in with the balls and bits and stuff like that. So perhaps the respect was not as big as it should have been. But my God, what he turned this team, this 92 team, into a winning machine for a number of years and surprised a lot of people.
Before the rest of this big interview, I'd like to tell you that our entire archive of audio and video content is now on our new YouTube channel. We've begun filming all of our interviews, and there are already loads of clips with guests, including Rio Ferdinand, Conor Cody, Brendan Rodgers, and Jamie Carragher, plus full interviews for you to watch and to share. Please do share with friends. Go to YouTube and search Graham Hunter, or click on the link in the show notes to this episode and become a subscriber. I honestly think you'll enjoy it. Thanks.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The first thing I need to say is that Rainer Bonhof says hello, because he was our last guest.
Oh, fantastic. He was a cracking personality. I really loved him.
Let me share a story. He told us during the interview, he sort of leaned in and said, I'm going to tell you a secret now. And sometimes people mean that, sometimes they don't. He said, when we beat Holland in the 1974 World Cup final, West Germany, he said, until 4 years earlier, I was Dutch. I said, what? He was Dutch, held a Dutch passport till 1970. His dad was Dutch. and yet he changed sides. So that's a nice little underdog story of its own.
That was a great story.
Look, Richard Moyer-Nielsen, you knew him, I think, because he'd also taken you in some of the underage teams, the youth teams. And because both you and your brother found it a difficult appointment initially, what I want to phrase it like, it feels like, irrespective of how good a coach he was involved in trying to make a transition. He had ideas which flew in the face a little bit of how Denmark generally wanted to play its football, enjoy its football, and transition in life, culture, family, football, isn't always easy, and it can take a lot of time to digest. When you're facing a brand new style of football, and he seems to stand for quite different values that you and your brother held, and proper values that had made you both, or you were on the route to becoming European superstar footballers, your quality was not in doubt. What was the most difficult thing about it? Was it the results, the Northern Ireland draw, the defeat in Belgrade to Yugoslavia? Was it about what he was asking the team to play like? Why initially did it not gel?
I think it's fair to say, and I think I have to take you a little bit back from his appointment, and is that when Sepp Piontek took over, it was at the back of, let's put it in the right way, you know, amateur footballers, again, perhaps a little bit the mentality that even though a lot of these great footballers played abroad, and we're talking the likes of, you know, Alan Simonsen,
Ballon d'Or winner,
when they came back to Denmark, if you go back to, you know, start of the 80s, it was always like, you know, when people would say, yeah, we go back, we have some good fun, we meet with all the other, you know, players, and then we go out, play a game, and that's it. Then we go back to the clubs abroad again. So you didn't have really the feeling that the players believed in that mission to actually, you know, win something or at least go to a Euros or qualify for a World Cup. Never happened. They were not even close. And then Sepp Piontek came in, and he turned, you know, the world upside down, you know, because he put in a regime that, you know, these players never experienced before, you know, and he wanted success. He wanted to, you know, for the Danish players to realize the potential that they haven't fulfilled it, not even closely. So what he did, what he changed a lot of things. He came with a German mentality, which is very different to our Danish, perhaps laid back approach. And you know, initially he was struggling a wee bit, but eventually he turned things around, and he created, I think, a personality, a mentality which had not been seen in Danish football before. And they qualified for the 84 Euros in France. And I think he initiated a wave, really, a belief, a way of playing, a style of football which created football friends throughout the world. And I think that's where at least a lot of people began to look at Denmark and say, this little country, how can they produce so many good footballers? What have they done? What are they doing? And I think, to come back to your question, Piontek, he started it, and Richard Moyer-Nielsen came in, and obviously, and I think our team as well had to live up to all these loved players, Prit Mjelke, as I say, Søren Lerby, Frank Arnesen, you know, they were the heroes of the Danish fans. And, you know, we were struggling to emulate that, because I think we were a good side, but perhaps didn't have as many good or great footballers as they had in their era. So for Richard Moyer-Nielsen, he was a different manager, no doubt about that. He was a cautious manager. He was a manager who says, okay, we'll start with defense and then we'll build it from there. And it was completely different to what Sepp Piontek did. So I think it took some time for Richard Moyer-Nielsen to actually figure out how he could get the best out of the likes of my brother, Michael, myself, perhaps even Jan Mølbø, who played very well for Liverpool back then. He was a great player. But it just seemed to me that he was struggling with the idea to have too many, let's say, lazy players in his side, you know, perhaps good footballers, great technique, but perhaps not the kind of footballers he loved. And I think that was the biggest question for me, that I didn't feel his, if I may say, his love initially. I felt that he struggled a little bit to find a way of us to play. And sometimes we even played in perhaps, in my view, some difficult positions we were not used to. And I think eventually, speaking to my brother as well, I made the decision to leave the national team at some point. My brother did as well. I have to say that for two different reasons. I think for my brother, he was very much involved with Real Madrid. With Barcelona back then, played a completely different style of football at his club. So he didn't feel that he was capable of being successful. And I just felt that I was not at the right place at the right time. So I quit the national team, and I do not regret that, to be honest. I think at the time I thought it was the right decision to make, but I'm really thankful and I'm really happy about the fact that Richard Møller-Nielsen, contacting me and say, okay, let's sit down, have a talk. Let's see if we can, remove all these differences and then move on. If that's possible, it would be great. If not, then at least we have made we have tried it.
I really like that theme. Number one, I've never heard anybody express it, which is not the main thing of why you stopped, but that it could have been perceived by many people, players and fans, that Richard Møller-Nielsen was tearing down something sacred because what Piontek had built was so glorious, so wonderful. And that idea about building friends around the world is very seductive. Everybody loves to be admired and people telling you, we love to see you play football. That's a nice feeling. To leave and take a pause, or maybe you thought it was forever, again, that's a grown-up decision because you must follow your principles. You must follow your heart. And it strikes me, there's many things in Danish education system to be admired. One of them is the hour that you get to express your opinions. There's a sort of pupils hour and you're taught to have an opinion and to follow it. And something that when we look at sheep around us today, that's my view, you don't have to. I can understand why you might feel enabled to say, no, this isn't for me, I'm going away. But equally in life, how many times do we wish that somebody on the other side of a disagreement or a breach reaches out and say, okay, let's talk again, which Møller-Nielsen did. And I assume that means, Brian, that he'd reviewed his own actions. He'd reviewed what he'd been doing that made you feel uncomfortable. So it must have been a mutual coming together rather than you just saying, yeah, okay, listen, I'm tired of not playing, I'm coming back. There was something mutual there.
Yeah, definitely something mutual there. I remember him coming down to Munich. I played at Bayern back then. And, we sat down for 2, 3, even 4 hours, I think, and discussed everything that had gone in between, and in the past. And I realized that there were some misunderstandings along the way, that by coming down to Munich, sitting down and discussing what we could do from here and move on in a positive fashion, that he was, really doing everything in his power to try and get the best players back into the fold. And I think by showing that, he showed me that he wanted me and wanted to perhaps not build the team because I didn't expect to be built around, but he would certainly try and put in the qualities I had into the team and implement that as well as possible, because I understood completely, as he told me, that perhaps the team that we had, following in the footsteps of the 84, 86 team, we weren't perhaps as prolific. We weren't perhaps as good in terms of, just going out saying we play our own football and hopefully that's good enough. We have to, go into some games in a pragmatic fashion. And I completely understood that. And that changed my mind, really. And, made change my view of him as well as a human being, as a person, as a manager. And I told him, you know, a number of times back then that I was very happy that we had this discussion, because it changed my international career, no doubt about that. And this meeting, I have to say that, was just 3 months before the Euro 92, as we are talking around February, March 92, that we are having this discussion. So we didn't know anything about 92 back then, but for me, it was a turning point. And I wanted to be part of Richard Møller Nielsen's, let's say, ideas going forward, because playing for the national team, as I say again, it doesn't come any bigger than that. And we had, you know, we had a marvelous team with the backbone from the Brøndby era. And I wanted to be part of that and do my bit. And so for me, that was the turning point. And I never looked back. I moved on from there. And we had some terrific moments together.
Tell me about, let's bust some myths, because I think you've done a little bit of that already. But again, talking to Peter Schmeichel, he said the myth was that we were all on the beaches. Myths are myths. The reality was we'd finished our seasons. The players who played abroad at the time and those in Denmark were still in their season when we were told. He says you were actually told in Brøndby. You were training at your old club, the club where it all began. When the news comes through, you're actually going to be put in there. And he talks about maybe some of the players mentally were on holidays, just a rest, just coming around the corner, thank goodness, because you've been preparing for a friendly against CIS. But he says physically we were in good nick. Mentally and physically, because you missed a couple of months of Bayern Munich. You'd been playing really well for Bayern Munich, in a decent Bayern Munich side. And you'd missed a couple of months, I think, with a knee problem during the build-up to that. Mentally and physically, as the news comes through at the training ground in your old club, where are you at?
I think I was the one Schmeichel told you about when he was talking about mentally being on the beach. But having said that, you know, it was one of the most strange moments I have ever, you know, tried in my career. I was just recovering from a cruciate ligament damage, and I came back and played a few games, as you say, for Bayern Munich in, you know, April, was in March, April. I was still struggling a wee bit. I was definitely not back to my best. And usually, you know, they always say if you're out for 6 months, it takes you 6 months to come back and be as strong. Physically is one thing, but mentally, you're always very worried about getting injured again and stuff like that. So I was told by Bayern Munich when the season ended in I think it was early May, to stay behind for a number of you know, closed door games and just to build on my fitness for the next season. So I came back from one of these games and you know, got into my house, and my wife, she greets me in the hallway and she says, I've just been contacted by the Danish FA. You have to report tomorrow. And I say, what? I'm not even fit for that, you know? And she said, yeah, but this thing about, unfortunately, about the civil war in Yugoslavia, and they have to, you know, they're not allowed to play in the Euros. So you're going, and you've got 8 days to prepare for the game against England. And my first initial reaction was, I'm not going, no way. No way. I mean, I'm not ready for that. I don't want to be. Let me put it this way. I mean, if you play in the Euro or let's say a World Cup, you need to present yourself as at the best of your ability and you know, at the top of your powers. And I was not feeling that way. I remember I looked at my wife and she says, what are you talking about? You know, you have to go back, prepare yourself as well as you can. It's a huge opportunity. It's a fantastic moment for Danish football. We've never played, these players never, you know, being at the Euros. We didn't qualify, rightly enough. Yugoslavia was a phenomenal side in that season. But unfortunately for them, you know, and they had to withdraw. And I think to show them respect, obviously we needed to go and do everything in our powers. So I remember, you know, I was very hesitant because I felt, you know, I don't know whether I can play one game. Can I play two games? Will it be like half an hour there, half an hour the year? But again, you know, I picked up the phone and I phoned Fleming Palace. You know, he was with Dortmund, I think, back then in the German Bundesliga, and we always played together up front. And you know, he was all over the moon. You know, just talking about what a chance it would be for this team to show the world that we can play a wee bit of football as well. So eventually, you know, I got the right feeling about it, you know, I was really looking forward to it when I sat in, you know, on the plane the next day and presented for training. I think it was 2 days after that. And you know, just, you know, meeting the guys at the hotel, it was ecstatic. It was like we've all already won it, you know. It was like we have been presented with a huge chance to sell ourselves as well as we can, to show perhaps the Danish fans as well, because we were not loved back then by the fans as much as we eventually were after the Euros, because we were, as I said before, you know, we're struggling a wee bit. You know, being compared with the 86 team, they were, you know, the golden, you know, boys, you know, played fantastic football, got to the semi-final, you know. They were loved back here. And we were like, the ugly duckling, you know, not playing as well, perhaps not as, you know, not having the same personalities as they had. So it was a fantastic opportunity for us, and we took advantage of it.
Thank you for listening to The Big Interview. It's produced by me, which sounds egotistical, but it's also true, Graham Hunter, and Back Page. Our music is by Beer Jacket, who else? Editing by Charlie McGarry. Thank you to our hosts at Acast and our loyal sponsors at Bet365. We're also supported by our socios. Find out how to become a socio, how to support us at patreon.com/Graham Hunter. Here endeth the lesson.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.